Hi, I'm Hans Tenboom with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning, Valley Forge, Greater Philadelphia, and everybody out there in internet land. Welcome to We the People, The Constitution Matters. I'm your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. I'm honored this morning to have with me my two trusty sidekicks, Pastor David Whitney, Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution, and Phil Duffy, Instructor of the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Widener University. Last week, we bravely started a new series, one that will take us probably well into January, exploring America's fundamental principles, the principles that have been responsible for over 200 years of almost unbroken economic and growth and prosperity, allowing the United States to rise to the position of being the greatest military and economic power in the world, and one whose constitution was used as a model for those of other nations for at least the next 150 of those 200 years. In May of 1776, Virginian George Mason warned us that without this frequent recurrence to fundamental principles, we should not expect to preserve our free government and the blessings of liberty. In Federalist 2, John Jay notes, "I have as often taken notice that Providence has been pleased to give us this one connected country to one united people. A people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs, and who, by their joint councils, arms, and efforts, fighting side by side throughout a long and bloody war, have nobly established general liberty and independence." So yes, we had a lot going for us in 1787, a united people, a common culture, abundant resources, and a precedent-setting, unique in history form of government, at that time yet untested, that the framers, particularly John Dickinson, hoped would last for eternity. We have survived and prospered, despite a bloody civil war and other challenges, but if you look around today, you see a very different America than the one John Jay saw. Today you see an America where a prominent black group is demanding a new constitution because the old one has, in their words, perpetuated racism, where college students are demanding their schools fire some of their staff and condemn so-called white privilege, where occupiers demand that government take steps to redistribute the wealth of the so-called rich to the so-called poor. An America where $20 trillion in official public debt threatens to completely collapse our economy. This is an America which threatens to literally come apart at the seams unless we come together to voice our concerns in a respectful way and find solutions that will retain the principles that are instrumental to liberty and yet allow us to continue to flourish as a nation. So today we'll examine the principle articulated by Thomas Jefferson that all men are created equal. What did those words mean as Jefferson's ink was still drying, and what should they mean today? We'll be taking our calls in the second half of the show, so please write these numbers down, 610-539-TALK, that's 610-539-8255. If that line's tied up, then 610-539-1783 and 1784 are available. So, Pastor David Whitney, what is your view of Jefferson's words, and how do we bring them to life in 2015?
Well, Jefferson's words, thank you, Gary, are absolutely critical to being essential to draw us back together to a political philosophy, and that's what I think we need to understand, because I'm going to explain what their thinking was behind this, and as I explain it, most people are going to respond to say, well, that's a theology. That's a belief system of a particular religion, and therefore that has nothing to do with law and government, which is the lie we've all been told repeatedly, that religious belief system has nothing to do with governance. What we need to understand is they had a political philosophy based upon a religious belief system, and that if you remove the religious belief system, you also destroy the political philosophy that was designed to create liberty for the maximum number of people. I know we're going to talk about the issue of slavery in a bit, so I won't delve into that. And Gary, I know you're going to do an excellent job of addressing that issue regarding the founders. But let's back up and ask, what does that mean? All men are created. Underline that word created, first of all, because it means that our founders did not believe in evolution. Evolution was an idea that was popularized by Charles Darwin. He did not invent the idea. In other words, people of the founding era, there were people in Europe who believed the idea of evolution even before Charles Darwin wrote his book. It was an idea that did exist, but it wasn't that popular. And our founders specifically rejected that idea because that idea leads to a political philosophy that says the strong ought to dominate the weak, which you would say, wow, if the strong dominate the weak, doesn't that sound like slavery and racism and so on? And yes, it does. In other words, the roots of racism and the roots of slavery based upon a person's skin color, all of those things really are rooted in evolution. It says one race is superior to another race. Our founders rejected that idea, even though we know they didn't have a easy, quick solution to the problem of slavery, although they saw slavery is something that should end itself, and they instituted in the Constitution a means by which it would eventually come to an end. But the idea that there is a creator, and that creator God is the one who is the source of all law, the source of what is just, the source of what is right, and if you reject that, then you're left with one form or another of evolution that says one set of men are better than another set of men, so these set of men get to dominate and rule over the other set of men. I would argue that what we have today is if you become a lawyer, which many people in our country don't respect lawyers for many, many good reasons, but if you become a lawyer, go through law school, graduate, pass the bar exam, and now you've got this degree, and now you've got a job as a lawyer, and if you're a successful lawyer and you rise to the top of the heap among lawyers, what happens to you? You get donned with a black dress. And somehow this black dress suddenly transforms you into the ruling class. That is, the people who get to make all the laws for all the rest of us and determine what is right and what is wrong, determine such things as, oh, say, two men can marry, changing, more than 6,000 years of human law and human tradition. You get to change that because now you're wearing a black dress and you're a lawyer. So if you have that philosophy of government, that certain human beings, by whatever means you determine, of course you could talk about the monarchies in Europe, they determined it by lineage, okay? You were born to this certain set of parents, and therefore you have the certain set of privileges that a person born to another set of parents does not have. If you reject all of that, as our founders did, and said, no, all men are created equal, and because they were created by God, God is the one who gets to determine the rules regarding what is right and wrong, what is law and what is unlaw, what is violation of the law. His standard of justice, his standard of righteousness is the standard that society that is truly in tune with the universe, the whole creation, that society is the most just society, which adopts his law and his rules for how human beings interact and how human civil government is to operate. Again, as I said, that most people in our country, even many who claim to be Christians, completely reject that philosophy of government. They've accepted a democracy where 51% of the people get determined what's right or wrong, and I like the best illustration I've heard about what a democracy is. A democracy is three wolves and one sheep deciding what's going to be for lunch? What's on the menu for lunch? Well, if it's a democracy, the three wolves, hey, they vote for lamb chops for lunch, That's the end of the lamb. Well, in a republic, which is what our founders constructed, and a republic, by the way, based upon God's law, this idea that there is a creator God and our rights come from him, not from government, and the sole purpose of government is to secure and protect those God-given rights. In that republic, everyone is equal under the law, and so the lamb has equal rights to life, liberty, and property, along with the wolves have equal rights to life, liberty, and property, and no set of three wolves can set themselves on a lamb and decide to eat him, and that be called law. No, that's not law. That's murder, and that's cannibalism, whatever. So when we reject the founders' philosophy of government, that there is a creator God, and that our rights come from him, the whole system our founders structured begins to crumble and fall apart. And so the idea that evolution is taught in every single public school, every single public institution, is proclaimed from the housetops by every means of media, and anybody that stands on the biblical theology of creation is mocked and ridiculed. And so, our tax dollars pay for somebody like Bill Nye the Science Guy. I think it's better, he's better titled Bill Nye the Propaganda Guy. His propaganda is paid for by we taxpayers on NPR and other, public outlets. The nostrum of evolution is everywhere, and it is absolutely destructive of the foundations upon which our constitutional republic was established. So we must understand Jefferson's words as they did, a philosophy of government based on the idea that there is a creator, that our rights come from him, not from government, not from 51% of the people voting for whatever, as in a democracy, but our rights come from him and him alone. And that means the American people need to go back to that original philosophy and discover that it is the source of true freedom and liberty. And again, that's what we do at Institute on the Constitution, creating courses and materials. People can check out our website, theamericanview.com, because we understand that if we're going to retain our freedom, we've got to get back to that founder's philosophy of government, that there is a creator God and our rights come from him.
Well, that's important, an important distinction. The people who would like to suppress the Christian religion in America trot out, of course, evolution to demonstrate that it just can't possibly be true, but then they don't want to live with the implications of that. They are willing to destroy or suppress that religion that gives them their freedom without really realizing what the effects are going to be. Well, that's a great way to look at it. Let me turn to my friend Phil Duffy now. And Phil, how would you characterize Jefferson's words? What sort of context do you think they should be put in?
It seems to me that we repeat these familiar words so often in the Western world that their obviousness fades to fuzziness. What do the words really mean? Feminists could point out that Jefferson didn't mean that women of that time were intended by Jefferson to enjoy equal rights with men, and they would have a point. Yet Abigail Adams, probably the most effective feminist of that era, warmly welcomed Jefferson to her table. So no doubt she could see that her distinguished guest had the right idea, even if the language didn't express it precisely. Perhaps she also noted the contradiction in Jefferson's idea and the fact that he owned and benefited from the institution of slavery. Her husband, John Adams, had confided his resentment toward Southerners and Virginians in particular, but Abigail retorted, "I am willing to allow the colony great merit for having produced a Washington." Abigail had a way of seeing the big picture and the longer view. She could recognize the potential good that exists in most human beings. So, like Abigail Adams, let's recognize that the concept of all men are created equal was an emerging truth, not fully developed in 1776. What then did the idea really mean? It clearly did not mean that we were created to be identical. Our biological differences are obvious, and perhaps those differences create a stronger society. It's not necessary that all of us possess NBA-level athletic ability or Einstein-level intellectual ability. This would probably be a boring place to exist if that were the case. So let's go back to an earlier time than Jefferson's All Men Are Created Equal and his life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Let's go back to Father Francisco de Vittorio of the School of Salamanca, who proclaimed in the early 16th century that all men are equally free on the basis of natural liberty. They were entitled to life, to culture, and to property. Father Vittorio is considered to be the father of international law theory. Note that in addition to the ideas of equality, life, and liberty, Vittorio's blast against slavery mentions a right to culture. Culture separates us. It doesn't make us identical. Vittorio was emphasizing that cultural differences are okay and not at odds with equality. So what is it that we mean when we say that all men are created equal? Consider the relationship of Vittorio's pronouncement and his role as the father of international law. He was saying that we are all equal before God and just law. He wasn't saying that all the natives of the New World looked alike and should be therefore treated alike. He was saying that they came from a different culture than the race that he had discovered the New World. Nonetheless, they were not inferior in the eyes of God, and they should not be considered inferior in the eyes of the law. That is the kind of civics view of all men are created equal to which I was exposed as a youth. I hear rumors today that this view is no longer taught and that instead the historical emphasis is on the tyranny that white Europeans imposed on Native Americans, on black Africans, on all women, and others. I won't deny that, and it would be an affront to the truth to excuse that behavior. That doesn't nullify either Father Vittorio's words or the efforts he made to defend the oppressed. We need to adopt Abigail Adams' position, building on what is good and discarding what is bad from the past. To build on what is good in the concept of all men are created equal, we need to recognize the limitations of law. Last week, I mentioned overlapping realms of human action, of which the law is just one realm. I mentioned the realm of voluntary exchange, otherwise known as the free market. And I mentioned that the realms of civility, charity, and humility. My point about these is that for humans to be considered free, they must have relative freedom to take action within these other realms and not be unnecessarily constrained by the law. When we accept the idea that all men are created equal, as stated in the Declaration of Independence, we are saying that within the realm of law, all persons should be considered equal, equal in the protection of the law, equal in the natural rights guaranteed by government, and equal in due process of law. But does that concept of equality extend to the other realms as well? Let's consider the realm of voluntary exchange. In one sense, the concept of equality is strongly recognized in that realm. One of the best examples was Branch Rickey's breaking of the color line in professional baseball when he brought Jackie Robinson to the Brooklyn Dodgers. Rickey had his moral motivation, but he was also a shrewd businessman. He realized that a gifted person of color could catapult a mediocre team to greatness, and that that would bring in new fans to Ebbets Field independent of color. Anybody who had the price of admission was welcome to the ballpark. That is equality in action in the marketplace. The realm of voluntary exchange may be the most democratic method of distributing goods and services in an economy, but it doesn't assure that everybody will have the same amount of wealth to buy goods and services. There will be a tendency to reward those who provide the greatest value to their fellow human beings with greater wealth, but nobody should claim that it is perfectly a fair system. At the same time, we should recognize that fair is humanly non-definable. Fair is in the eyes of the beholder. By contrast, no national economic system that attempted to divide wealth equally has ever been successful. To the contrary, the growth of such systems stagnated economic growth and existing wealth accumulated in a new class, such as the new rulers in the communist world described by Tito's right-hand man, Milovan Gilas, in his book, The New Class. George Orwell's pig, Napoleon, observed in Animal Farm that in such societies, all animals are equal, but that some are more equal than others. Let's consider the relationships of people in the other realms, civility, charity, and humility. In the realm of civility, people treat each other according to the golden rule. All are due respect unless they prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that they are not deserving of that respect. In the realm of charity, the giver and the receiver are definitely not on the same level. In this realm, inequality leads to a more virtuous society. And finally, in the realm of humility, the humbled voluntarily accepts a lesser station while society as a whole is augmented. My point in investigating these other realms is that the concept, all men are created equal, has boundaries. It is only within the realm of the law that the concept holds absolutely, that in the realm of voluntary exchange, it tends to be implemented naturally for purposes of acquiring goods and services, but clearly is not operable for acquiring wealth necessary to acquire the goods and services. The concept of equality applies in the realm of civility, but without the coercive arm of the law, and it is inapplicable in the realms of charity and humility. I'd like to close with an unsettling thought. We should not look at Jefferson's "all men are created equal" in isolation. "All men are created equal" is an assumption Jefferson made that led to the conclusion that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. Those governments were not to be the responsibility of a ruling class as they had been in the past. They were to derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. So how can anybody enjoy citizenship in such a republic and insist on equality before the law and not assume some responsibility for the government, including its reasonable cost and its guidance? Isn't it strange that we hear so little about that aspect of equality today?
Well, absolutely, and that you hit on a key point there. That you, if you're going to participate in this system, you have to take responsibility for its cost and its guidance. That is, you can't sit back, not vote, and complain about what's going on in the country. Now, David, I think you hit on something really important there. When you said that when you're in a political system that has been informed by religion, as our system has been informed by Christianity, then you're in a system where God sets the rules. And, of course, we take umbrage when anyone sets the rules for us, including God, typically. We say, well, you know, we don't need God. We can conduct our own lives. We're the master of our fate, the captain of our soul, and yet we forget what the implications of that are. And as you pointed out with evolution, you know, if you're going to replace, if you're going to send Christianity to the sidelines and replace it with evolution, you've got to live with the implications of that, right?
Amen. And it seems to me that that's what's happened, although Americans haven't seen the connection between evolution and a dominant class of people ruling over us. We've believed a lie that somehow we still have our freedom, when in fact our freedoms are being stripped away from us. Those who have studied the Constitution can see all of the examples of our Bill of Rights being gutted, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, Seventh, and so on. And what we have is a class of people who are making those decisions for us without our permission. We only granted them certain limited enumerated delegated powers in the Constitution. And as the Heritage Foundation studied, they believe that 90-plus percent of everything done by Washington, D.C. every day of the week is a violation of the Constitution. So we have a rogue group of people who are destroying our God-given liberties instead of preserving those God-given liberties and telling us all the while what they're doing is perfectly just and right and that we should just be quiet. We should just not oppose them, and that if we do speak, as I have and spoken around the country on the issue, then that we are the hate mongers. And I've been labeled a bigot and a racist and a homophobe and all sorts of things for simply telling people what our founders said the Constitution actually means.
Well, we'll be right back in a very short after this short break to continue our discussion of equality. Don't go away and don't lose those phone numbers to call in. We'll see you in a moment.
Hi. right here in Philadelphia, broadcasting freedom shining light throughout the tri-state area. Streaming freedom shining light from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station. WFYN.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Chris Foster. Mali special forces have stormed a hotel where Islamist gunmen are holding hostages. About 80 now, we're told, are free of the 170 hostages believed to have been held inside, with at least three people dead. Global Radio News reporter Sidi Hadara in Bamako, Mali.
In this hotel, you have many foreigners, especially you have French people, you have some UN people, and you have some other big VIPs. And I think it's for this reason that they wanted to attack this hotel.
Mali's in West Africa. Bamako is the capital.
We think that it is a terrorist attack. And we think that there is a connection between what happened in Paris, in France, I mean, this week, and what is happening now in Bamako.
A Mali army commander says 10 gunmen stormed the hotel, shouting, "God is great," before shooting at guards, throwing grenades, and taking hostages. The U.S. Embassy is telling Americans in Mali to take shelter. This is a Fox News alert.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
We the People t-shirts, where freedom is always in style. Famous quotes from patriots throughout U.S. history printed on the back of our t-shirts. We do over 25 quotes in a variety of colors. High-quality t-shirts with a meaningful message that make people think. Encourage others by reminding them about patriots of conviction who have gone before us. Order directly from wethepeopletshirts.us. For more information, call 757-645-8878.
Andrew Jackson once said, "As long as our government is administered for the good of the people and is regulated by their will, as long as it secures to us the rights of persons and of property, liberty and conscience, and of the press, it will be worth defending."
Welcome back to We the People, the Constitution Matters. If you're just joining us, we're embarked on a series of shows examining the fundamental principles that build America, principles that the founders knew would produce the greatest amount of ordered liberty. Last week, we examined the principle of self-government, and this week we're taking on perhaps the most controversial topic in this country at the moment, that of equality. In the first half of the show, we heard from Pastor David Whitney, who reminded us that it's the theory of evolution that really sets up this system of inequality. It certainly presupposes that certain creatures are more efficient and effective and able to survive than others, and there is a system of inequality built into that. And in the second commentary, we heard from Phil Duffy, who reminded us that equality is very often in the eyes of the beholder. It's difficult to assess and difficult to quantify, and we need to be careful that we don't presuppose that we know what equality really means. So let me take a stab at this and give you my view of what I think Jefferson had in mind. "All men are created equal," wrote the slave-owning Virginian in June of 1776. But is it fair to call Jefferson and the other founders racist because they owned slaves? We look backward through our post-Civil War, post-13th Amendment glasses, and we think the issue is clear. And many modern authors have not hesitated to level the charge. But is there more to it? Jefferson was not the first to proclaim that all men are equal based on natural law. The Roman jurist Ulpian expressed a similar thought in the 2nd century A.D. Richard Hooker in the 16th century and John Locke in the 17th century preceded Jefferson, as did his friend George Mason, who expressed a similar sentiment in the Virginia Declaration of Rights a month before Jefferson sat down to draft his own document. But since Jefferson's declaration has been declared part of our nation's organic law, we'll focus on him. Now, black indentured servants had been arriving at Jamestown since 1619, along with white indentured servants. They were not slaves in the modern sense of the word. Each indentured servant normally won his rights to land upon serving his indenture. And for an Englishman or a European of meager means and few prospects in a depressed economy, free passage to America in exchange for what was normally a 5 years' work as a servant or a laborer was an attractive option, sometimes their only viable one. It was not till 20 years later, 1640, that it appears the first indentured servant, a black man named John Punch, was made a slave for the time of his natural life, as it was said, after fleeing his indenture and being recaptured. By 1690, slavery had been codified in the laws of Virginia and other southern colonies. By 1776, however, indentured servants were largely out and slaves largely in amidst a flourishing slave trade. It is estimated that nearly 12 million Africans were shipped across the Atlantic from Africa, although only 6% of them were thought to have landed in British North America, with the rest going to the Caribbean and South America. All right, how about Jefferson? In 1757, Peter Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson's father, died, and Thomas, then age 14, inherited approximately 5,000 acres of land, including the family's estate at Monticello, and 20 to 40 slaves. Jefferson did not receive complete control of his land and these slaves until 1764, when he turned 21. That year, if Jefferson had tried to free his slaves, he would have gone to jail, because back in 1723, Virginia had abolished manumission, or the freeing of slaves, and that would remain the law in Virginia until 1806. In 1806, when Virginia allowed the manumission of slaves, Jefferson was halfway into his second term as president. To put the dilemma that Jefferson and other founders who inherited slaves faced, let's put the situation into modern terms. This isn't a perfect comparison, I'll admit, but it's the best I can come up with. Let's say you and your young wife have two young children. To keep everyone fed and clothed, you've taken a second job as a night custodian. You are very environmentally sensitive, however, so much so that you finally decide that the internal combustion engine is a threat to the survival of humanity. The cost of a Prius, however, puts it out of reach, and you live a good 5 miles from the nearest bus stop. So here's your dilemma. Do you sell your only car and commit to bicycling to work each day or walking, or do you suck up the moral dilemma and keep driving to your two jobs to feed your family? This is pretty much the dilemma that the founders faced. They had estates to be maintained, and they had slaves that they inherited. So what do they do? In 1772, Jefferson married his third cousin, Martha Skelton, and with the death of Martha's father the following year, the young couple inherited even more slaves. Over his lifetime, it is estimated that Jefferson owned over 600 slaves. About 175 of them were inherited, and the rest were born on his plantations. Despite realizing the economic necessity of slavery to maintaining his estate, Jefferson was not blind to the moral conflict it created. He included in the draft of the Declaration of Independence a very heated denunciation of the slave trade, aimed primarily at King George. But his words threatened the sought-after unity of the colonies, and it was stricken at the request of the Southern delegates. In 1779, Jefferson proposed to the Virginia legislature the training and resettling of slaves. And 3 years later, he drafted legislation allowing owners to free their slaves in Virginia. It failed to pass. In 1782, for a very short while, it did become legal in Virginia to free slaves, but only upon one's death through your will. In 1784, Jefferson proposed legislation to the Congress to end slavery in the Western territories, beginning in the year 1800. It was defeated by one vote. 3 years later, brought a partial victory, Congress passed the Northwest Ordinance, which prohibited slavery in the Northwest Territories. In 1808, as president, Jefferson had the pleasure of signing legislation that banned the transatlantic slave trade the moment that the Constitution's prohibition on such legislation expired, bringing his denunciation in the draft of the Declaration to fruition. Unlike most slave owners, Jefferson paid his slaves for the vegetables they raised and the meat and fish that they provided to the estate, and for extra tasks that they performed outside normal working hours. Jefferson was indeed a most generous man. He contributed to churches and to ministers his entire life. When he died on July 4th, 1826, on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration, a few hours prior to his old friend John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, who had given much of his adult life to his nation, who had even sold his precious library to Congress to raise funds to keep his estate functioning, was at that time $100,000 in debt. Like many who had contributed to the funding of the Revolution, Jefferson's loans had been paid back with depreciated money, returning only about 2.5% of the value he had loaned out. To free all of his slaves at his death would have made his heirs nearly as destitute as he, yet still he freed five of them in his will. Now, bottom line, Jefferson tried repeatedly to bring an end to the institution of slavery most of his adult life. He foresaw the inevitable end of slavery, and he gave us in the Declaration the reason why it had to be so. Now, much has been made of Jefferson's remarks in his only book, Notes on Virginia, where he compared the physical attributes of black slaves to free whites. But even Jefferson admitted that this was a shallow comparison of blacks that had been oppressed and denied education, and not intended to reflect an appraisal of all blacks, both free and slave. As president, Jefferson even hired a black man, Benjamin Banneker, to survey the brand new city of Washington, D.C. Now, Jesus said, "The poor you will always have with you," which I take to mean that our nation's war on poverty, so-called, was folly if it expected to eradicate poverty in America. And in fact, we see that after spending more than $22 trillion since President Johnson declared this war, the percentage of poor in this country has remained fairly constant and has even seen a steady rise in the last 8 years. But economic inequality is only one measure of equality being challenged today. Commentators point out that people of color make up about 30% of the United States population, yet they account for 60% of those imprisoned in our jails. Is that a reflection of inequality, or are there other reasons for the seeming disparity? Should we declare a war on that? Some point out that 10% of the U.S. population controls 73% of our national wealth. Is that a problem that even needs addressing, let alone one that requires the power of governments to be brought to bear? Certainly, government has the power, not always just power, as Jefferson would term it, to take from the rich and give to the poor. It already does this, in a limited way, at least through progressive income taxes. But which is better, to give a man a fish or teach him to fish, as the saying goes? In 1833, Alexis de Tocqueville wrote that, "Among the novel objects that attracted my attention during my stay in the United States, nothing struck me more forcibly than the general equality of condition among people." Now, before we go launching into any more wars on today's inequality, we should also listen to de Tocqueville's warning. He said that a people who demand government action to eradicate inequality are, in effect, asking for tyranny. He called it a certain path to servitude. We can ask government to fix our apparent inequalities. We can hold sit-ins on college campuses and we can block the streets of New York. But in the end, we will all end up as prosperous as the slaves of America's past if we head down this path. Now, I see we've got at least one caller on the line. So let's go to our friend Claude Dunn in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Claude, you've heard three different views of this aspect of equality. All men are created equal. Do you have a comment or a question?
Yes. I love your show. It's very informative. You have three men there that are very articulate and knowledgeable of our founding principles. And I think the simplification of the whole thing is that our founding fathers wanted equality in securing to each man the right to use his own life, liberty, and property as he saw fit without the interference of others, as long as they did not violate the equal rights of others. This is the equality and fairness that we're talking about, not redistribution of wealth and that nonsense. That is not fairness. That's based on theft. You can't redistribute other people's wealth without stealing from them. So the fairness that the founder set up was actually a freedom to exercise your own skills and abilities to chart your own course in life. As long as you did not harm others, you were totally free to control your life, liberty, and property. And this is what the government was set up to do. This is what the common law through natural law being an element of common law and the Republican form of government all kind of wrapped into one where this rights comes through the governed is a beautiful system, and we need to get back to it.
Well, you're right, and as Phil pointed out, this fairness or this idea of fairness is certainly in the eyes of the beholder. And unfortunately, the eyes of our beholders, if you will, have been skewed somewhat in the modern era by competing philosophies. And so kids who have been raised thinking that evolution explains everything and that that is the prevailing explanation for what they see, then they're looking at this equality issue through that lens. Phil, you want to elaborate on that that fairness in the eyes of the beholder? If in fact our education and our upbringing has colored our ability to see clearly, what's the corrective action for that?
Well, it's interesting that the founding fathers seem to have a very strong grasp of human nature, recognized its positives and its downside, and realized that in order to form a government, it would be necessary to recognize human nature and to constrain it and direct it in a positive manner. And so, you know, when we look at the concept of fairness, I mean, just think of our own lives and how we observe the behavior of others. There is no doubt that each person sees this through a singular lens. We all see this slightly differently. Now, there's a certain consensus there, but on the other hand, there's also the temptation to see fairness in a way that is self-rewarding. So it seems to me that you almost have to be very, very cautious about the concept of fairness.
Well, yeah, and it almost requires you to get out of your skin, so to speak. To separate yourself from all that has made you who you are at that point, and step back and take a rather clinical and unbiased and analytical look at the situation before you proclaim that there is inequality. I mean, let's take this statistic where blacks and brown skin people are 60% of our jail and prison population, yet they only account for 30% in the United States population. Well, you know, on its face, that statistic by itself yells inequality. But is there a reason for it? I mean, if I don't know this to be the fact, but because I haven't researched it, but if in fact people of color are committing 60% of the crimes, then it would stand to reason that they would end up being 60% of the prison population. So, you know, you've got to look further than just the surface statistic that you think reflects an inequality of situation. David, what do you think?
Gary, that's an excellent point, and just a little bit of research I've done in that area indicates that it was not always so that the percentages of those black and brown were in prison, but the result of the destruction of the black family is the cause that many researchers in that realm of criminology, the destruction of the family, the fact that the vast majority, over 80%, of those incarcerated, whatever their skin color, are there, and they are the product of a fatherless home. That is, destruction of the family has contributed greatly, and so the war on poverty that you mentioned earlier was actually better termed a war on black families, to destroy black families, and the result of that destruction of black families is the incarceration and the creation of a criminal class.
Well, here's the statistic on that. I read this just recently. In 1965, when this war on poverty was commenced, poor black families about 20% of poor black families had a single parent. Today, the statistic is more like 70% of black families have a single parent. So where'd they go? And does that account for some of the continued poverty that we see today?
And that's an interesting point, because supposedly the war on poverty was going to create equality. You know, well, it's wrong that some people are poor and other people are wealthy. Let's redistribute the wealth. Let's do a war on poverty. The result has not solved the problem of poverty in our country, and the result has instead destroyed family governments, and that results in this high incarceration rate. But the interesting point of that is that the war on poverty was essentially an attack upon the equality principle of all men are created equal. If all men are created equal, they all have an equal right to keep the fruit of their labors, and therefore if you're going to take from one group of people because, well, the fruit of their labors is larger, they get a greater income per year than the fruit of another person's labor, and you're going to give to that person who makes less money the fruit of the labor of the person who makes more money and claim that that's equality? No, that's not equality. As I think Claude Dunn pointed out, that's really a form of theft. And the basis of that really destroys, as we've seen, the family in that community, as well as destroys some of the motivation for work. After all, if you could sit home and receive a welfare check and not go to work, you know, many people will choose to do that. In other words, destroying the incentive to even work. And now we have seen this in multi-generations. One generation of welfare recipients becomes their next generation, and you have grandkids whose grandparents, they've never known anyone in their family that hasn't been receiving a welfare check. So you create a class of people who are permanently in this status of welfare recipients. In a sense, you might say they've been put back on a plantation. However, this plantation doesn't require them to do any work, just fill out paperwork for the government in order to receive their welfare check on a basis that is to their liking, but actually not to their benefit. It's to their destruction of their self-image, their respect for their own ability to do work, and multi-generational destruction of the family in that community.
There's an interesting quote I ran across from Baron Montesquieu. The founders called him the celebrated Montesquieu, at least in the Constitutional Convention. He says, "In the state of nature, all men are born equal, but they cannot continue in this equality. Society makes them lose it, and they recover it only by the protection of the law." So it is the law, the rule of law, that is so important to recovering, in Montesquieu's view, any semblance to equality. Phil, how can you quantify the effect of the rule of law to this question of equality? How much of a role does it really play?
Well, I think I'd like to go back, if I can, and maybe I'm a little off track here, but bear with me. I'd like to go back to these related ideas of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which was Jefferson. And then life, liberty, and estate, which was property, and that is attributed to John Locke. Life, liberty, and property and culture, Vittoria. And how that contrasts with liberté, égalité, and fraternité, the motto of the French Revolution. It sounds like it's the same, but it really isn't. The French Revolution had no respect for life. Witness the guillotine. It emphasized equality and also brotherhood. So did the mixing of equality and brotherhood into the legal system taint it? How did the French Revolution employ government to implement the concepts of equality and brotherhood? By removing the heads of aristocrats. So the idea being that those who remained were equal and brothers. So that's an example of the coercive nature of government that we see. And I think you could see an evolution from that kind of thinking into Marx's concept of from each according to his needs and from each according to their means. You know, it's pure utopianism, and it applies in so many ways. Basically, it ignores human nature. And this is the thing that our Constitution is so strong, and it emphasizes human nature and recognizes human nature.
Well, yes, it does. But that recognition of human nature comes from the Christian view of man. And David pointed out that that one of the reasons I think modern man recoils at Christianity or any religion for that matter is that it implies that God sets the rules. And we say to ourselves, no, we're going to set the rules for ourselves. No external force is going to set the rules for how we conduct our lives. But that's not going to work. That just can't work. Robert Winthrop, who lived from 1833 to 1892, said, "All societies must be governed in some way or another. The less they may have stringent state government, the more they must have individual self-government," as we talked about last week. "The less they rely on public law or physical force, the more they must rely on private moral restraint. Men, in a word, must necessarily be controlled, either by a power within them or by a power without them, either by the word of God or by the strong arm of man." Those are the choices, and so the people need to say, all right, how do I vote? Which is going to lead to greater liberty and greater freedom to continue my life the way I want to do it. So we're almost out of time here, and I think this has been a really great discussion. Next week, the folks who missed our segment on self-government will have a treat because due to the Thanksgiving holiday, we'll be replaying that show. And then we'll pick up in a couple more weeks with another fundamental principle. Just like George Mason wanted us to do, we're going to keep on steady through this recurrence to fundamental principles. They are important. They constitute our government. They give us the foundation. And we're going to look at each one of them in turn. So we'll see you next time on We the People, the Constitution Matters. Bring somebody new with you and come prepared to give us your comments and questions. See you then.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenboom with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.